Hello, folks, and welcome to the June 12th edition of Dead Pit Radio. I'm the Creepy Kentuckian.
And I am Uncle Bill.
And got a really interesting show for you this week. I know it's one of the fan favorites here on Dead Pit since we started in late 2005, early 2006. And that would be the Horror Roundtable. I think this is the 12th edition of the Horror Roundtable. So we're going to have that beginning in the next segment, featuring our good buddy Adam Dick Joy Beck, a.k.a. Buzzkill, and the legendary, infamous, mysterious Schlogs.
That's right. So after we get done with the big roundtable, though, we're also going to have some DVD reviews. And we've got specifically one that I think both these have been requested by fans for a long time, but this one in particular is Punisher Warzone.
And the other one we'll have for you is The Girl Next Door from Jack Ketchum's magnanimous article or book or whatever. I don't know what it was. Was it a book?
It was a book.
I wonder if Jack Ketchum... No, shut up. We got actually have a member, unofficial Dead Pit member in the studio this week.
Say hi, Noodles.
Noodles doesn't want to talk to you.
So, Noodles, you need to shut your fucking mouth when we're doing this show. Do you understand we're doing something important?
Noodles doesn't care, buddy. He just wants treats.
So anyway, The Girl Next Door.
Against the fucking cabinet over there.
The Girl Next Door is the other one we're taking a look at. We're going to go through your fan mail. The fan call-in portion will return next week. And it's going to be a buttload of fun this week on Dead Pit.
Yeah, it sure as hell is. What are we going to do now? We ain't going to do no news.
Not really any news. The biggest thing, I guess, that we could briefly mention is the Phantasm 2 news bit. That it was broke this week that Universal is releasing the long-awaited, much-anticipated Phantasm 2, finally on DVD officially.
Yeah, so now the world can end. We can all burst into flames and we can all be happy because they've officially released everything that anybody has ever wanted to be on DVD.
It's true. I mean, I was thinking about that as far as like the big, I know that Horror Hound Magazine had a big article on like the movies, the most anticipated movies not yet on DVD or something like that. And it's almost, you can use that as a checklist now, really, because all that stuff, you know, we broke the news right as that article was hitting that Night of the Creeps was coming out. And now you have Blood Diner coming out, Phantasm 2, Hurthoff. Well, we can't really say that officially yet, but...
What are you talking about, buddy? What are you talking about?
A lot of stuff, though, we'll just say that. And, we're looking forward to it all this holiday horror season, I guess, of Halloween.
Yeah, so I don't know any other news besides that. I guess we can just go forward now.
Yeah, let's move along. So we're going to take a break. We actually have, you're going to have Adam Beck on the next segment, but by God, he's not just giving us a roundtable this week, helping us out with a roundtable.
Really?
He's doing another fantastic episode of Back
to the Future.
What's going on, guys? Adam Beck here for this week's edition of Back to the Future. There's a whole lot of films to talk about this week, so I'm going to try to rush through these and get them done as quick as I can. This week, back in 1978, 20th Century Fox released Damien, Omen 2, in 525 theaters. The film opened number one at the weekend box office, taking in $3.8 million. In 1984, two rival studios were going head-to-head for the number one spot as both Ghostbusters and Gremlins were released on the very same weekend. Ghostbusters was released by Columbia Pictures and opened in 1,339 theaters, whereas Gremlins was released by Warner Brothers, opening in 1,511 theaters. Ghostbusters, however, debuted number one at the weekend box office, taking in $13.5 million, where Gremlins came in a close second, taking in $12.5 million at the box office, so just $1 million separating the two. And actually, one of my earliest childhood memories is of my parents taking me to go see both of these films when they first opened. In 1987, 20th Century Fox released the action horror film Predator in 1,623 theaters.
Hello, this is Sonny Lambert.
The film opened number one, taking in $12 million. The following year, MGM released the third and final film in the Poltergeist series. Poltergeist 3 opened in 1,471 theaters and debuted number 5 at the weekend box office, taking in $4.3 million. Unfortunately, this film marked the tragic passing of child star Heather O'Rourke, who played Carol Ann in all three Poltergeist films. She unfortunately passed away 4 months prior to this film actually being released. In 2005, Lionsgate released my favorite horror film of the last decade, High Tension. The movie opened in 1,323 theaters and debuted number 10 at the weekend box office, taking in $1.8 million. In 2007, Lionsgate released Hostel Part 2 in 2,350 theaters. The film came in number 6 at the weekend box office, taking in $8.2 million. And finally, last year, Marky Mark starred in M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening, released by 20th Century Fox. The film opened in 2,986 theaters and debuted number 3 at the weekend box office, taking in $30.5 million. I'm Adam Beck, and this has been Beck to the Future for the week of June 8th.
Howdy, folks, and welcome to the 12th edition of the Dead Pit Horror Roundtable. I'm, of course, as always, Uncle Bill.
And I'm the Creepy Kentuckian. And we got a couple of really special guests on here. And I hope everybody's ready to get schlogged tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Because we do have actually a fan favorite. They voted for you as like one of the, I think, the number one voted request for the Horror Roundtable. It schlogs.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
And, of course, a legend on the board, the creator of the Beck to the Future segment, and the biggest buzzkill of them all, ladies and gentlemen, we are joined by none other than Adam Beck.
Woo!
Woo, baby!
Woo!
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys.
Okay, so, anybody want to start, or should we, or we're pretty
I've
easy.
I've got something.
Okay.
I was talking with Hydroponic about this earlier, but and it has to do with the show a bit. But when I started listening to Dead Pit, I had about 30 scattered DVDs, I would say. And in the past year, from listening to you guys, my collection has grown to over 200 DVDs that are just horror films.
Wow.
And I just kind of wanted to address and touch on how the line between being a genre enthusiast and being a fan of horror films and studying them in general and becoming an obsessive collector. And because I've got to the kind of, I've gotten to the point where I'm starting to buy movies and I'm not even watching them. You know, it's just, it's all about completing yeah. a director, you know. If anybody else has any ideas on that.
Yeah, I would say that there's definitely a fine line between just being like an enthusiast and a total pack rat. I mean, I have a three-bedroom condo here in South Florida, and I have an entire bedroom that's basically acting as a storage unit for all my shit. You know, all my toys, videos, posters, like cardboard standees, like all this stuff. I don't know. I would say that really you start to become a pack rat when you start going to places like Big Lots and Walmart, and you just start buying movies for the simple fact that they're only $3 or $4, where you know in the back of your mind you'll probably never watch any of these films. Because that's really what pack rats do. They'll go to, stores, or they'll find stuff and somebody threw out in the garbage and they'll just bring it home and, they have no use for it, but, they just buy the shit or bring it home, so.
Well, I'm noticing more and more, though. I mean, it sounds a little bit like me and Uncle Bill, but we were talking the other night, or maybe it was last night, I'm not sure, about some of these DVD updaters on YouTube. And it seems like a lot of these guys just get these DVDs to do these videos. And it's like they never have an intention of ever watching those movies all. And it's like, oh, I got this one right here. It looked pretty cool. The cover looked nice and everything, you know. And
well, I'll tell you one thing from my perspective, though, that I think you and I both agree on is that after a while, if you watch enough horror films, it starts to feel like there's something wrong if you're not watching horror films. Like, you just become sort of ingrained in the genre so much that if you, you can't, that's the thing that you seek out. Like, if you're an addict and your drug of choice was heroin or something, and that's what you just use, and then every now and then you'll use, you know, some pot or something like that. But in this case, you know, it's like you watch an action film every now and then, but you always go back to horror films.
I mean, I definitely think that there are people worse off than me. I mean, I'm pretty bad, but there's certain people that we know that they just won't get rid of a DVD. They won't. They'll keep it, you know, just to increase the size of their collection or whatever. And we sell off shit every year at the conventions or eBay or whatever, you know, because I simply just don't have room for it, you know. I mean, there's no way I can hang on to all these, and I don't really see myself ever watching, like, I don't know, what could we say, Frankenstein's Bloody Nightmare ever again.
I just thought we'd say that, yeah.
So, well, yeah, I've definitely noticed that with things for me, like, now it's turned into the kind of an obsession. I got to have the ultimate edition of a film, and it has to have the slipcase attached to, like, these Friday the 13th, you know, films coming out in the deluxe edition, quote unquote. And I'm not even very much of a fan of Friday the 13th, but then you see it at Walmart and it's $13 and it's got that shiny case on it and it's, well, I gotta get it. And now three more are coming out next Tuesday and I feel compelled, I guess, to pick those up as well. I don't understand why, but I seem to, even though I have them on VHS, you know.
Yeah, I would say, like, basically, like, the best way to avoid becoming like a pack rat is just to basically just support the films in theaters, and I would say only buy the, you know, the DVDs or Blu-rays that you really like and you know that you'll watch over and over again, because there's always like services like Netflix where you can rent films and you know, watch them at your leisure. You don't have to buy every single film that comes out and, you know, like, just blind buy shit that comes out on Tuesdays, you know. It becomes a bit much after a while. You end up, next thing you know, you got, you know, 500 or 1,000 movies and you have no place to put them.
Yeah. I like having 5,000 movies, actually.
Well, you could, like, if you ever got sick of them, you could just open up your own DVD store.
I think there's some sort of weird, like, there's this thought in the back of our head, or definitely in the back of my head, that at one time or another, that I'm going to be just sitting there, and I'm going to be like, you know what? I should really watch fucking Ghoulies 3 right now, or something like that. You know, I'm really going to have an aching desire to watch Sleepwalkers, you know, one night or something. So I have to buy everything that I see that has to do with horror, because there'll be a point in time when I'll just have this desire to watch it, but it never comes. It's just, I don't know.
Well, sure. I also think that a big factor for me is this belief that for some reason the film will vanish unless I purchase it immediately and all prints will be tossed into a big fire in the middle of town square or something. I feel like if I don't get it and order it immediately, it's just gonna, I won't be able to pick it up anymore, which is ludicrous considering all the options available, you know.
Well, you never know though, man. I mean, some of these companies like BCI folding up and all that stuff skyrocketing, like Savage Streets for one. But you know, I definitely see what you mean. I mean, I usually think the same way. But the problem with me is now is I'm waiting on the Blu-ray of them to come out. So
yeah, that's how I am too. I usually won't even touch a DVD that comes out. I just wait. You know, if you wait 4 or 5 months, usually the Blu-ray comes out. I don't want to, you know, be double dipping on it so soon. You know,
yeah.
At this point, I don't even want to buy DVDs anymore, just because I invested all this equipment for Blu-rays. I don't want to be, you know, purchasing stuff on the DVD format, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of why I'm not really sweating that we didn't get the Friday the 13th 4 through 6 DVDs, because I'm sure within another 6 months or so, those will come out on Blu-ray, and, you know, it'll be the exact same stuff.
Yeah, it's already happened with the first three.
Yeah.
So it'll definitely be coming out soon.
But that sort of, I guess, brings me to the next topic, to my topic here, on where do you think DVD goes from here? I mean, we just got the announcement this week that Universal was releasing Phantasm 2, which was one of the last big movies that has yet to come to DVD. And it's like you were talking about earlier, big lots are lowering their prices, $3. Walmart has $4, $5 DVDs. seems like the value of DVDs in general are going down. And, like, where do you see DVD in 5-10 years from now?
I was just, I'm worried that it's going to go to a, kind of like how you have a DVR and at home you can order movies on demand. And I'm fearful that it's going to go to the kind of thing where everything is going to be on the internet. You can order a film and, you know, have a wire that'll put it right into your TV and pretty much, I mean, because CDs and buying music, and I used to love to always have the case with the liner notes and the cover, and that's completely gone. I don't even buy CDs anymore. I haven't bought a CD in forever. And I don't want that to happen to movies, because movies to me are more like books. It's like having the definitive edition of a serious piece of artwork, and music is just kind of this transferable thing, and it's become just kind of a floating technological entity. And I don't want movies to go that way, because I like the 2-3 disc collections with the cases, and you know, having a book, having a shelf filled with all these things to kind of display, because it's important to me in that sense. And if it goes the way that CDs have gone, I don't think I'll like that very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's already sort of going in that route. Like, you know, I did a YouTube video. I bought that Roku digital video player that Netflix put out, and you know, you can basically download any movie that they have on there. I mean, they only have, I think, like 12,000 right now. But I think in the future, like you're saying, I think pretty soon that's going to be like pretty much the way of the future. You'll just be able to click on something and download it. But I think they're sort of trying to do away with DVDs at this point. I really think that Blu-ray, I know Uncle Bill hates it, but I really think that Blu-ray is going to end up, you know, taking over within the next 5, 10 years definitely. Maybe 5 years. I think, I mean, just the fact that every DVD or every TV that's out there, they're all high definition at this point. There's no point in really continuing on with a DVD format that, you know, it's not basically compatible. I mean, it's compatible with the TV, but, I mean, why would you want to watch something that's, you know, 480, you know, P when your television displays images at 1080, you know?
Yeah, Uncle Bill.
I won't get into a Blu-ray argument, but as far as like where DVD is going to go from here, I honestly don't know. Like, I never in a million years thought that it would get to the point where almost every movie that I've ever wanted to see come out is going to come out. Like, as a matter of fact, I think that probably hurts horror in general more than just about anything I can think of, because for the longest time, people were chasing all these films, and it wasn't really the fact, I don't think people really wanted these films to come out. I think they wanted to talk about them and kind of have that anticipation about there's these lost films floating around out there. And, you know, you kind of, the chase is better than the catch type of thing. You got to pursue these films. That's what's kept all these people going on these message boards for so long. And now they're coming out with all of them. It's like, where does anybody go from there?
Definitely. That's a point that I agree with completely. It's been, you know, growing up and reading in Gore Zone and Fangoria, you know, back in the 80s, reading about all these different movies out of Italy. And, you know, I would only be able to get a couple or three of the Fulci films. And you couldn't even find the Dario Argento movie where I lived. And now all of a sudden I can go online and I can go to the store and the Best Buy by my house has a Cannibal Holocaust 2-disc Grindhouse edition. You know, it's that available, all of this stuff, and that certainly does detract from the mystique and the fun of the whole thing. If you know, you can go on YouTube and you see these kids that are like 18 years old sitting in their bedroom with every bizarre underground gore film you ever heard of, and they already got it before you because their parents gave them the money to order it. I mean, it is depressing in a sense, so I agree with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is with DVD now is, it's like, and I feel this way, I mean, even though I don't really buy DVDs like new movies anymore, but it's like, if somebody sees a brand new DVD at Big Lots for $3, why are they going to want to go to Walmart and spend $20 on a new movie? Like, I just don't understand. I can't believe hardly anybody's buying these anymore. They must be, but I mean, to me, it would make more sense to either buy them used or buy the cheap shit at Big Lots.
Yeah, but I mean, Big Lots doesn't have every single movie either. You're still gonna have to go other places to find certain DVDs. But I think that people still chase after these films, because I think with Blu-ray, I don't think they're really gonna put out these same films on Blu-ray right away. So I think people will still be like seeking out the out-of-print DVDs of certain movies and stuff. So I think that whole chase for movies will still be there, I think.
Yeah, I definitely hope so. And another thing that it boils down to, I think, in the future is going to be what it seems to be always coming back around to is just lazy motherfuckers. It's like the convenience of it. Like DVR is definitely going to, because I find myself buying stuff on DVR just because I don't have to do anything. I just have to flip over to the channel that it's on and click on it. I know there's certain films that I'm only going to watch one time. And so, you know, I don't even have to rent anything for that matter. That's definitely the way it's probably going.
Something I'm noticing more and more too is though I'm sure you guys have seen these in Walmart and Best Buy and stuff. The multi-packs, like they have four movies in just one DVD case or whatever. I don't know if they have them on two DVD flippers or whatever. And you can get them unbelievably cheap, like four movies for $7 now or something like that. So I'm just surprised at how cheap it's went down. Compared to like the early days of DVD, which is similar to Blu-ray's prices now, I guess.
Yeah, I think they're just trying to phase out DVDs at this point. Really, I mean, I think that's why you can find them so cheap, is that they want to push Blu-ray movies for you to go out there. But I think it doesn't really help much though. It's like you could buy a movie on DVD for, you know, like $8, and then, or you can buy the Blu-ray for like, you know, $25-$30.
Yeah.
You know, I think in that case, I think it kind of hurts Blu-ray by them doing that.
Hell, and something else, I don't know if you guys even know this. I have yet to see this at Walmart. They have, like, season double packs of, like, the X-Files. Two seasons for, like, $15 or something. That's crazy.
I guess in a way, though, I mean, that's good for people that like the show and stuff. You actually get a chance to see it for really cheap, but I can understand that.
I don't know if it's good for the format, though.
Well, the assumption is that the cheaper the stuff gets, the less valuable the DVDs are. But it depends on how you look at DVDs. If you look at them as like a commodity, that's probably true. But if you look at them as kind of like a piece of film that people can enjoy for cheaper, it seems all right to me.
Well, I think the more anything is available, it will inevitably be devalued. And that's why DVD is going that way right now. While you can find pretty much anything, even at a used, kind of like a disc go round type place, you can find really weird movies because so many people have them and so many people cycle them through their collection, I guess.
So let's keep the DVD dream alive here. Okay. This is a topic that was up on the board for a while and it seemed to get a pretty like heated response, so I figured I'd bring it on here. Just in general, do you think that with all the 3D, the remakes, the PG-13, do you think that we're going through like a drought of films, just of ideas and good films and stuff that's similar to the 90s? Do you think that there's any truth to some people's assumption that horror is dying?
I wrote a response to that, but I think it's pretty much just cyclical and we're going through a transitional time right now, and we've got done with the torture thing, and we've got done with the influx of Asian ghost remakes and kind of that whole element. And right now, Hollywood is generally standing around and taking a wait-and-see approach, and there's always a big boom of a certain type, a certain subgenre of films that is really popular, especially like the ones that we just had that were so connected to what was going on in the world. And now that that has died down and we've had, you know, the decades changing and we have a change in administration, I think we're just in a transitional period. Wes Craven said something in the latest Fango about that's just what happens when studios don't know what's coming next and they're not willing to take a gamble. They just basically go through a ton of remakes, just kind of treading water. I don't think it'll ever die. I mean, not outright. I mean, I can't imagine the day when, you know, there's just no more genre films being produced. I think we'll see a lot of direct-to-video stuff.
Yeah.
And the aforementioned remakes, but I have definitely noticed, though, that I can't believe how few films are making it to the theater. I mean, like, you think about last year, 2008, there was literally something like three films that could be called horror that made it into theaters in a wide release. I mean, that's just unreal how low a number that is.
Yeah, and I guess when I say dying, I mean more like the mid, before 96. Like, I don't think it ever really dies, but there's definitely points when you don't even notice it. It's so minimal.
Yeah, I think it's sort of getting to that point now. I don't think it'll ever just, you know, completely die out. But, I mean, it's not just horror films that they're doing that with. It's everything, you know, action films, you know, comedies, everything. They're just remaking tons of stuff. Most of the time people don't even notice because with, like, other genres, it's stuff that's real obscure. People don't really pay that close attention to, you know, those types of films anyway. But, yeah, I mean, I think that, I don't know, I think they'll just pretty much remake everything at this point. To the point that they have nothing else to remake, and then I think they'll kind of be forced to try to come up with some new ideas at that point. But yeah, it definitely seems like it's, I don't know, the whole remake thing's kind of run its course. But the one thing I do notice now, it seems like the big thing is 3D films. They're really pushing that with, you know, horror films and kids' films. There's just tons of it coming out. I think I've seen maybe 3 or 4 this year already that are, you know, in real 3D, which, I mean, it's kind of cool to have that, to actually go out into the theater and see it. But I think it kind of sucks, that whole gimmick, because once it comes out on DVD, it's not the same. You know, you can get your little, you know, your red and blue glasses and put them on, but it's not going to be as good as it was in theaters. And if you watch it in 2D, a lot of times they'll have these, like, certain scenes that were set up for 3D, and it just is kind of, you know, hokey when you watch it in regular 2D.
They should definitely come up with some sort of device where you can watch it in real 3D at home. I mean, I don't know. There's probably a reason why they can't do that, but I mean, yeah, I agree with you. When it comes home to DVD or Blu-ray, I mean, it just doesn't. With the red and blue glasses, they do nothing to me except give me a headache. So, but as far as like theatrical, I mean, I don't. As bad as like, I mean, I think that this decade hasn't been hugely successful for horror, but I mean, I think it's about 10 times better than the 90s was. I mean, I think that you've seen great films throughout the whole decade. I mean, I don't think that every year, like you were saying, I mean, last couple of years, not a whole lot of theatrical stuff came out, and there's been a ton of remakes, a lot of which remakes, I don't know what the executives are thinking, because other than the big named horror films like the Halloween, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, those will always make money. But I mean, they released like 15, 20 other ones that didn't make a dime. You know, they failed miserably.
But I got to say though, for the last decade, I haven't really, especially for the last 3 or 4 years, I haven't seen like a point to any of the films that they're making. Like, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, they all had a film that was some sort of, like, it took the genre into another direction. It had some sort of focus or some sort of point to it. And, like, stuff, you know, it changed things. But it's just here, there's no point to any of this shit. It's just, let's see what we can churn out there. And you know it's going to make a certain amount of money. It's not going to do great. It's not advancing any ideas or anything.
You didn't think that Rob Zombie's Halloween had a special message about the art of skull fucking?
Yeah.
Well, I think that what you say, I don't know if I totally agree with that. I think that the bigger issue of about horror dying, or, you know, on the wane, so to speak, is that, like, you take something like a Scream in the 90s, like, movies that everybody, I mean, we'll talk about all of them because we're hardcore geeks like that, but we haven't really hit upon very many films in this decade that everybody's talking about, that the casual film goer is talking about, or it's being written about. I've seen some, you know, scattered articles about the so-called torture porn genre in mainstream magazines like Entertainment Weekly, but it's basically just a really, you know, curt overview of kind of what's going on with that, and, oh, this is a sign of the times, and then they, you know, forget about it. But there's been no movie that could be classified as horror that's got everybody talking whatsoever, I don't think, is the big problem.
The closest one, though, and I hate to say this, would be the first Saw movie that I would put in that category, because that is the only one I can think of that. See, I didn't even want to see it because it never looked interesting to me, but that was one that everybody was talking about when it first came out, and it had a big buzz to it, you know.
I fucking hate Saw, man. That movie sucks. But I'll say that I think the French are really trying to push the envelope with horror and try to, you know, put out some stuff that'll get people talking. But the thing of it is like, as good as, like, you know, High Tension and Martyrs is, Hollywood is, like, purposely trying to fuck French films up as well. Because, I mean, look, they take Alexander Aja, they bring him to the United States, and the guy's done, you know, what, 3 remakes now. And it's like, you know, recently I watched that movie Them for the first time, and I thought it was a great movie. And then I'm looking up that director, you know, to see what else he's done, and he did The Eye with Jessica Alba, that remake. And then it's like, you know, Inside comes out, and that's a great film, and you know, Hollywood's jumping all over those guys to do the Hellraiser remake, and then they drop off, and then they're all over the fucking guy that did Martyrs, and he signed on for a while, but I guess he's off now. But it seems like, I know, it's not, like, I guess good enough for them to ruin, you know, American horror films. They have to, like, go overseas and try to, you know, ruin any chance of those guys doing anything.
Well, it's like I said, they missed the point. They're like, okay, this guy is a really, really talented director. Now let's take him and basically chain his fucking hands behind his back. You know, let's put him in this format. He made this really great original film, so let's make sure that we put him in something where he's doomed to fail, like a remake, you know?
Well, the part of it is, too, is you got to find a director that's got a backbone as well. I mean, I'm not going to blame the fucking executives for putting Alexander Aja, or whatever his name is, in that position. I mean, he had the chance to say, no, I'm not going to do that, but he didn't, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of the problem is that these people are given the keys to the kingdom, and it's really almost impossible to resist. You know, Aja could have, you know, I personally think that his Hills Have Eyes remake is a great movie and really of its time and was an excellent updating of that story to, you know, the current, what's going on in the world. But then, yeah, then Mirrors was just a mess and, you know, he's doing some silly twaddle like this Piranha thing, which it might be amusing and it might be gory, but at the same time, is it necessary? Is it anything that's going to be truly interesting? I don't think so. And these Julian Mowry and Alexander Bustillo guys have kind of, it seems like both those guys and Pascal Laugier dumped off of the Hellraiser remake probably because Weinstein's wouldn't, you know, let them do what they wanted to do with it. So that's a positive sign, but whether or not they continue in the genre is entirely up to where, you know, the benefit lies for them. Mm-hmm. That's what, I don't know what these guys are going to do next. They have these great debuts and then they've basically just kind of been in developmental hell for the past 2 years and haven't got anything done.
Yeah, it's just amazing, too, that these studios are willing to, you know, give one of these guys, you know, like $15, $20 million to do a remake of a film, and they could probably just give them, like, $5 million and say, hey, you know, here, take this money, go out and make something original that fans will like. You know, it's just sort of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But do they want that? I mean, do these directors want that? A lot of these guys, you look at the path that Peter Jackson and Sam Raimi have taken. I don't know, is there such a thing as a director who gets into the horror genre and says, you know what, I want to make hardcore for the fans, you know, horror efforts my whole career. I think a lot of directors get into filmmaking and go through the school and go through the whole effort of it because they eventually want to get to the point where they're making $100 million dramas with Tom Cruise and Denzel. Look at Cronenberg now, whoever would have thought, but
yeah.
These people, if they have talent, I don't believe that they want to be chained to the horror genre for their entire career. They want to go somewhere else with it usually.
Right.
Yeah, that's fine, but I would say just, you know, go out and make original films at least. Doesn't have to necessarily be horror, but you know, when you're just going to end up like Aja or somebody and just do like remake after remake, like you said, there's nothing you're really getting out of that, like, you know, creatively. It's just basically, it seems like they're just doing films just to make money rather than
well,
being an artist.
And I can't believe that they think that would advance their career either, just to do a remake. I mean, and all the guys that I can think of that have done horror films that have just stuck with the horror genre, nobody knows who the fuck they are, so I guess, I mean, I respect
exactly.
them, but I guess that doesn't, that me respecting them probably doesn't do a lot for them.
Well, that reminded me, though, when we interviewed Lucky McKee a couple years ago, there's another guy that just, it seems like he's just fucking missing in action or something. Like, he just, and he was talking about to us that he's just not really offered anything new or original. It's all remakes or something based off of, you know, a book
or something. A
graphic
novel
like, yeah.
or a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he was involved in that film Red, which I thought was really great, that Ketchum adaptation. I don't know exactly what happened or, you know, he shares directing credits with someone else, but Yeah, he's definitely a guy where you wonder why isn't he, you know, he could make the next Silence of the Lambs for all anybody knows. He's got a real vision and he could make something that didn't get everybody talking and not just some horror nerds on a message board, you know. He's got that sort of a talent and he's not being given the opportunity, and I guess kudos to him for sticking to his guns and not just taking the swill that they give him, but it'd be nice to see him put something out.
Yeah. So who's next?
See, I guess, what is the most, I guess, shocking or disturbing horror film you've ever seen?
I've got one.
Right.
I just saw on Runk Russell's recommendation a film called Cannibal, directed by Marion Dora. I think it might be a French film also, but it's on Unearthed Films, and that was a movie that, after watching it, I don't think I've ever felt that disgusted and sickened and tired of the human race in my whole life. It was absolutely repugnant. Has anyone seen that other than me?
No, I missed that one.
I missed it, too.
I haven't seen that.
It's basically that story of the guy who went online and found somebody that wanted to be eaten, and the guy met up and he wanted to be eaten, too, so they just got together and... Yeah, the whole movie's pretty much, he saws the guy's dong off, and then he bleeds out, and he hangs him up in his tool shed, and for 45 straight minutes without any dialogue whatsoever, he violates the corpse and cuts it to pieces and until there's essentially nothing left. And just watching somebody dismantle a human body for 40 minutes without any dialogue or story, it was really disheartening to sit through. So check that one out right away, guys.
Wow. That's one you can watch with the whole family.
Yeah, that's like a glowing recommendation right there.
Yep, watch that with my son. No, just kidding.
What you got, Bob?
I would say for me, and it's probably, I'm sure this is nowhere near like the most shocking film, but like it's just one that really bothered me, is a film. I know Uncle Bill seen this, the film that Trauma put out in, I think, around 86 called Combat Shock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if you guys have all seen that. I know. Has, but
that's just a depressing fucking film. Like, I don't even know how to explain it. It's kind of like a Joe Spinell film meets Taxi Driver or something like that. It's just, by the end of it, you just feel like you live through something. You don't feel like you've even watched a movie.
I've got it, but I haven't seen it.
I would say like, basically, if people haven't seen, it's like this guy who comes home from Vietnam and he's suffering from, like, post-traumatic stress syndrome and hallucinations and flashbacks and shit when he was a POW. And basically, he has his nagging wife who's always bitching at him that he needs to find a job. And he has this, like, extremely deformed baby that's hilarious looking. But if you can overlook the fact that it's, you know, so, I guess, cheesy. But it's basically, he has a deformed child because of his, I think it was his exposure with Agent Orange when he was in Vietnam, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's basically just a day in the life of this guy, and he basically just, he goes out and tries to find work, and he basically just observes all this, you know, urban decay that's occurring in the city with, you know, drugs and child prostitution and stuff. And you know, overall, I would say it's definitely a very powerful film, and the thing that disturbed me the most is the ending. That really bothered me a lot. I don't want to give it away, but
yeah.
I know you've seen it, so.
Well, it's just one of those films where every single thing that happens in that film, there's not one point in it where you're like, well, that could never happen. That's silly or something like that. It never breaks form. It's wholeheartedly, it's complete in its attempt to depress the shit out of you.
Mm-hmm. For me, though, I mean, a movie that completely disturbed me, I mean, it's kind of hard because I always go back to, like, if a movie really bothers you, you're never going to want to watch it again. It's just going to sit on your shelf, collect dust. And there's a couple ones that I can think of that was sort of like that. But, I mean, I don't know if you would consider them horror movies. The Traces of Death series. I don't know if you guys have seen this.
No, I've seen them all. I knew a guy that, when I lived in Ohio, he used to jack off to those and eat spaghetti dinner.
Well, that's a truly sick motherfucker.
Yeah.
But
oh yeah, that's why I don't talk to him anymore.
It was one of those, though, like, you'd be dared to watch it by your friends at birthday parties, whatever, growing up. And they would always make everybody sick. I mean, because it was real. All that shit was real. It wasn't like the Faces of Death movies where some of the stuff was staged. Some of it was real. I mean, you would see a guy take a shotgun to his head. Blood would come pouring out of his nose like a faucet. I mean, it was sadistic shit. You would also have these death metal, what was it, Cannibal Corpse?
Yeah.
Or something like that in the background, too, which even added more to it. So, movies like that. Then growing up watching the Cannibal movies, of course. Cannibal, I think Make Them Die Slowly was Cannibal Ferox on video. I watched that when I was like 11 years old. That really disturbed me quite a bit.
Yeah. There's been a very few films that I've actually had a deep reaction to where I was like really seriously fucking disturbed by them. I can think of like Last House on the Left being one of them. Actually Martyrs here recently as well. So it's pretty amazing that they could do that to me after all this time. But by far the one that I was like most, I could not believe what the hell was going on. It had to be Mortem. August Underground's Mortem. I was just like, I was watching it thinking to myself, there's no fucking point for this film to even exist in this universe. And then, but as it turns out, you know, talking to Fred Vogel and stuff, I see his point in making it, but I was really mad about watching that film. Like,
well, that's another one, too. Like, he even says this. It's a movie you don't want to watch again. It's like, one time is enough for me. I'm never going to watch it again, you know.
I mean, there was a film where I was just like, this guy, whoever made this film, I was thinking at the time, they just have absolutely no morals, no decency, no respect for any. And come to find out, that was the point. I mean,
they're mongrels.
Yeah.
Usually that would be a plus for me in my book, the absence of morals and decency when going about producing a film. But for some reason, when I saw some parts of that movie, it didn't affect me very much other than I thought it was kind of, I don't know, I know there's some fans of it, but it didn't do anything for me. And I thought, really, am I supposed to sit here and watch this for like more than 10 minutes? I mean, I shut it off pretty quickly. I think I would have had a lot more respect for the film if he had actually distributed it on subways and just put it in people's mailboxes randomly. I think that would have been a lot more in touch with kind of the point of the series. But when you're making something like that and, you know, it's got a product tag and people can go meet the people who made it and have them sign the disc, I mean, it kind of destroys the illusion completely, and then you're just watching mean-spirited stuff, you know?
Mm. Yep.
Yeah, if you watch that thinking it was real, yeah, that would really fucking bother you. I have all three.
And
of
if he wanted
movies,
to make I'm sorry, I'm just going to say if he wanted to make a real impact with people, then that would be the only way to do it, because you can't, you know, break character. And once you have, then it kind of destroys, in my opinion, the entire spirit and the point of producing the film in the first place. But like I say, just my opinion. Go on.
Yeah, I would agree. Like this might sound really lame, but when the Blair Witch Project came out, there was a documentary, like a fake documentary on a Sci-Fi channel, and I watched it and I actually thought that the Blair Witch Project was real.
Well, fuck, I did too.
Like, I don't know why. Just the way they presented it, I really thought it was real. And I was gonna go see it like Friday night, and I think Thursday night my friend had seen it, and he basically spilled the beans to me, telling me that it was fake. And I actually remember seeing, I think it might have been the next day, they had the whole cast on, MTV, like TRL or some shit, talking about the film. And that just completely ruined it for me, because then when I went and saw the film, I was just like laughing at how stupid it was. I could never get into the movie at all, just these people like in the woods bitching at each other for, you know, 45 minutes, people, you know, sitting in a tent with no lighting, crying about somebody outside shaking the tent. You know, I couldn't get into it. That's probably like a movie that I know a lot of people like, but I fucking hate that movie. And, you know, August Underground films, I have all three of those films, and I previewed them. Like, I'll put them in for like 5 minutes, and I just turn them off. I can't get into them. It's not so much the fact that they're like really disturbing. I mean, I guess they kind of are if you thought they were real. But the fact that I know they're not and they're just actors, it kind of grosses me out in a way, like the vomiting and stuff they do. But I need more to a film, really, than just,
well,
you know, straight gore.
In a way, it's just kind of fucking sad, too. It's like, here you got all these people that they've got in there to fucking, you know, get puked on, and I don't know. I don't understand how you get something out of that, you know?
Well, it's something that, I mean, this may very well be true, but when we were interviewing Fred Vogel, he said that those girls were into getting puked on.
Right.
Because of the art scene. And
right. That's a big scene in Pittsburgh. The
I didn't know it was art getting scene. Vomited on. I mean, I'd never heard of that kind of art before.
Well, yeah, I do that all the time.
So. Oh, really?
It's the kind of art where you're providing your own therapy for a daddy complex, perhaps. I don't know. It's some sort of emotional, personal issues that are you have to expel in a way. I don't know. But it's, I don't know. I've never really found those films to be that impressive.
I would say that Fred Vogel's pretty amazing. That imagine if, like, one of us thought up an idea, like, hey, you know, I'm going to make this movie, you know, where I fucking, like, tie up women in my basement and torture people and shit. You know, and you know he didn't pay anybody to be in this movie. I would almost guarantee it. If he did, he probably didn't have much money to pay him anyway.
Yeah.
How do you, like, talk people into doing something like that in the first place? If I did that, they'd think I was fucking crazy. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, oddly enough, I kind of respect him because, like, I just respect him for the fact that he could piss me off. Like, that I thought I'd seen everything in the world that I could possibly see to have any kind of reaction. And here comes this film, and it just affected me that much. I kind of do respect that, even though it's a horrible thing. I don't know. Anyway.
Let's move onward, guys.
Definitely. Well, I had one that kind of ties into what we were just talking about, actually. I was going to kind of pose to you guys, what is it about being a horror fan? What is it in our personality? I'm certainly not suggesting there's anything inherent in the genetic makeup of a genre fan that, you know, there's no nihilistic bent just put into us at birth, but what is it about us that when we hear about something like that, like the August Underground, I heard extensively about them, and I didn't like the idea of the content, and I didn't like, you know, what kind of stuff was in them, but I still said, you know what, I have to see that. I have mm-hmm. to see that, because, you know, every time I hear about something more and more upsetting or more like, oh, this death scene is so realistic in this movie, there's this thing that clicks in my head, and I think in most of ours, like, the more graphic the bloodletting, the more realistic, we just are compulsively drawn to check it out. It's kind of like Martyrs. Why is that movie, you know, engendering so much love and respect from people? It's like we've finally felt something again. We were finally impacted by how brutal and sadistic this movie was. And what is it about us that makes us feel the need to... I don't think... These are scenes and images and ideas that most people in polite, normal society do everything they can to avoid seeing when they watch a film, and we seem to seek them out solely.
Yeah, well, I just want to say real quick that there are some films that I watch, like Laid to Rest, solely for the purpose because somebody's told me that there's, like, these amazing death scenes. But I didn't get out of Martyrs what you're saying, like, that I watched it because, and got, that the torture and stuff was the reason on. I mean, I actually got something out of the whole story behind that film. I didn't much like the torture aspects of it. I mean, they were pretty fucking brutal, but the end result of the film.
But now, yeah, I think everyone's brain is sort of hardwired in terms of having like a sense of curiosity about death and destruction. I mean, if you put on the local news, most of the time that's all they ever talk about. You know, this guy was killed, this child was abducted. You know, all this sick shit that's happening locally. I think with horror fans, maybe that sense of curiosity is just a bit stronger than with other people. I don't know. I don't really know the whole psychological reasoning about why we like it. But I think, too, like as a horror fan, when we would watch horror films as a kid, they would really bother us. They were scary and shit. And as an adult, we sort of become desensitized, I think, to a lot of these films where, we can still enjoy them and stuff, like most of the films we watch, but more on, like, a technical aspect where we, like, we point out that, we love these, makeup effects or the directing or the acting, but they don't really, like, scare us. So I think that a lot of times we like, seek out films that are maybe, like, disturbing or just to sort of get that same feeling that we had when we were a kid. Because, I mean, I normally never like get that involved into a film. I watch them. I watch Laid to Rest. I enjoyed it, but it never really, it doesn't scare me, doesn't bother me or anything. And mm-hmm. It's sort of like what Uncle Bill was saying with, like, Martyrs, a lot of times these films, the story can really be something that disturbs you. I think that, you know, a lot of times they have this, like, underlying message to them that really makes you think. I mean, you know, it's fucked up as, like, you know, Cannibal Holocaust might be. You know, there's an actual message there, you know, the statement that the writer was trying to get across, and that, you know, we're actually the ones who are the savages, not these, you know, primitive people living out in the rainforest, you know.
You got anything over there?
I don't know. To me, it just like what Adam said, I mean, when you're a kid, you watch it. It's sort of like a roller coaster, I guess, like getting on a roller coaster. You just want to be scared. You want to see what's, you know, what's going on. But as time goes on, you watch these movies to sort of, I don't know. I mean, for me, I want to feel the same feeling when the first time I watched Psycho 2 when I was 6 years old, you know. I mean, you want to find that next movie. And now it's really, I mean, if you want to relive your childhood, you sort of can. It's sort of like if, you know, you go back in time, like in The Butterfly Effect, but they sort of fuck things up, and that's what we get these remakes now, like Halloween 2 and shit.
Hmm.
So,
well, I think on a certain level, Drag Me to Hell worked that way for me, because I can't even remember the last time I was scared by a movie, but seeing that in an audience, and people were actually screaming their heads off. And but then the other thing is, you know, what they have to do to elicit a response from us nowadays. Like, you guys talked in your review about how loud that movie was.
Mm-hmm.
That was the loudest damn thing I've ever heard. And I've been in IMAX theaters that weren't half that loud. And every single scare of the film was punctuated by the most grating, like, awful, extremely loud noises. And it was like, I was more scared of the assault on my eardrums than the content of the film. But I, you know, I took my dad back, and I saw that movie 3 times in the theater, and every single time I noticed after certain scares, even though I knew they were coming, my heart was still just pounding in my chest, because I was so attacked just by the volume of it, the sheer intensity of it. And I think that Raimi was really clever, you know, to use that as a tool, but at the same time, That really says something, that if, you know, that's how you have to draw it. I mean, the atmosphere didn't really, you know, get that from me, and it doesn't in a lot of movies, but that's what they have to do to draw that sort of a reaction out of us nowadays, is, you know, resort to technological tools to almost, you know, crack your eardrums.
Yeah, it's tough, because the majority of the people that are going to see horror movies now are hardcore horror fans. So you gotta try to think of creative ways. And I mean, that was a great idea to do that. And I'm wondering if there's any speakers that were actually, you know, ruined because of that movie. I would think that there would be, actually, because that shit, like during the seance scene especially, like, god damn.
Oh, when they were all covering their ears?
Yeah.
Yeah, I took my dad to see that movie, and he's always talking, my mom is always saying, turn that down, and he's playing his music too loud, and he loves the big sound of everything. I took him to that movie, and he was, after 5 minutes, after the first intro, he was covering his ears for the rest of the movie. He said, this is too loud. How can you stand it, you know?
Yeah, I saw that movie, and I have to say, like, I agree. That movie just completely stressed me out. Like, a lot of the jump scares didn't even work for me, because there were so many. I was kind of, like, looking for them. I was expecting them, like, at any second. The seance one definitely got me. But, yeah, when I left that theater, my heart was just racing. I felt just really stressed by just the sound and just the overall movie. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, but I wanted to get back to the question that you were talking about, you know, why it is we like this shit and why we like to be scared and all this stuff. There's one argument that I always hear, but I haven't ever gotten this. It's the one where they say it's a cathartic experience where you get to see people killed, and therefore it makes you feel better about your own death and all this shit. I've never one fucking time, just for the record, gone to any film and been like, oh, I feel killed by dying now. I can die in peace.
You feel worse.
Yeah. That has never one time happened to me. So that argument to me is completely bullshit. I think it's more like going at this point to see a magician and pointing out all the tricks and seeing, like, how much they can trick you. And, you know, like, because we think we know it all. That's why it's great when somebody actually pulls something over on you, like throw something there where you're like, I don't know how he did that, or that's amazing. That's what I go to it for.
Like David Copperfield.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if you got off on just, like, people getting killed, you would just watch, you know, the real shit. You watch Traces of Death and all these other, you know, films rather than just, you know, horror films. Okay. I don't know anybody that really gets off on seeing somebody get killed. I mean, it's a safe way to experience somebody getting killed, but I don't know anybody that would really enjoy that. It's kind of just, I think, one of the stupid stereotypes that people put on horror fans. Like, they're weird or whatever. Like, I remember... this was maybe, I think, 4 or 5 years back when I was living with my parents still. They had a furniture guy come in the house, and I think he was delivering a desk or something. And he took a peek in my bedroom, and you know, he saw all my horror shit, and he, like, made a comment like I was a serial killer or something because I had all this, you know, horror stuff. It's bullshit. I think that's just stuff that the media comes up with just to discredit horror fans.
Yeah, I think people would be surprised, actually, at, like... how many horror fans, like horror movies, that would absolutely not be interested in, like, the faces of death, the real death. Because the horror films are like, everybody knows it's fake, you know, these are all actors, special effects, and stuff like that. And I think there's a whole different audience for the Traces of Death, Faces of Death, August Underground movies, stuff like that.
Well, yeah, I need production value. I need to see some sets and some lighting and some cinematography. I can't just, I don't find it compelling or interesting, certainly as sort of a rubbernecker, you know, driving by an accident, but that's why I love Fulci films, you know, at least, you know, the main three that are so great. That's why I love those, because they do have, you know, an amazingly talented group of people putting every piece of the puzzle together, from the music to the lighting to the set design. And it's just, that's what I go in for more. I mean, the gore is just kind of the topping on the cake, but I really do need some sort of something to appreciate from an aesthetic point of view, from an art direction point of view.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. You know, I can't watch, like, the real death stuff. That stuff really bothers me. You know, anytime I see someone getting killed for real, you know, I just can't stomach that. And, like, now that I think about it, it's pretty fucked up, but when I was probably, like, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old, my dad used to rent Traces of Death on me to watch them with him. I don't know why. Yeah.
There was a lesson in there somewhere. I don't know what the hell it was.
I guess. Clean your room, you're going to end up like the kid.
Did you pee your pants then, too? Or...
Do what?
Did you pee your pants then, too?
Oh, like, no, that was just the one time. I never did that again.
That was the only time he actually did it in theaters, right?
I almost pissed my pants one time. I was at work, and I was eating, somebody brought in pot brownies. And I ate one, and like an hour went by. I don't usually smoke pot or anything. Actually, I'll say that I don't, because I know my parents are probably listening to this. But, but I ate a pot brownie, and then, like, you know, an hour went by, nothing happened. So I ate two more. As soon as I got done with that third one, I was just fucked. And I remember the whole night, I had to work the rest of the night, and I was just trying, I don't know why, but I just thought I was going to piss my pants real bad. I remember I went into the bathroom, and, like, all the stalls, I think I was hallucinating, I don't know, but there was, like, all these guys in the stalls that were farting, and it sounded like R2-D2. Like the sound of-
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you were hallucinating.
Yeah, but that was the only other time I almost pissed my pants.
But
I don't think I did.
Moving on, though.
How do we segue out of that? Yeah. There ain't no way.
I got one.
Okay, go for it.
All right, you guys are going to Whorehound Weekend in Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
How scared are you of getting raped by Mike Knopf?
Oh, shit. I'm pretty scared myself.
You know the guy's going to show up. He's from Cincinnati. He said he was at Fright Night, too, so.
Yeah, he's going to wheel up on us with his devilish grin.
He was, yeah. He was at Fright Night, but for some reason we missed Fulci Fanterra. I don't know.
Yeah, that's weird.
You figured a hot broad like that, we would have definitely noticed her, especially in Kentucky, because they don't exist that much around here. No, I mean, I'm sure they'll be there. It'll probably be awkward, but it's something we're going to have to take a photo with him, Uncle Bill.
Oh, I can't wait. I'll sit in his lap.
Oh, my God.
Will you really?
Yeah, I will.
Good luck with that.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. I think we've both been thinking, this is mainly why we started the show a few years ago, because we think horror in general, the horror genre, is way too politically correct now as far as mainstream stuff, you know, even publications. What do you guys think about it? Do you think, like, some of the more hardcore stuff needs to come out to theaters now? Some of these magazines need to loosen up, you know, and quit promoting all these guys that just French kiss their assholes.
Well, I don't think that, you know, Rue Morgue doesn't need to loosen up anymore in regards to being on PC and tackling any issue or any topic. And I think that the whole problem with why everything is the way it is in the theaters is because it's, you know, the business has become such a huge business, and to release a movie in theaters, you need to have studio backing, and studios second, third guess themselves constantly on everything. Like, I've been wondering why it is we hear about a movie like Trick or Treat. Well, what did we first start hearing about that about 14 years ago? And this thing is, oh, it's going to come onto DVD. No studio is willing to take any sort of a chance with anything. It has to be test marketed or like Midnight Meat Train. Why do these movies? It used to be, you know, people would get together, throw a movie together, and they'd say, ah, that'll sell, put it on this little circuit. And nowadays it's like, well, when's the release date going to be? How much are we going to spend on TV ads? And it's this huge process, and it takes year after year, apparently. And eventually it'll just get dumped on the DVD anyway, or like with Midnight Meat Train in dollar theaters. I mean, it's completely senseless, and that's the worst aspect of it, I think.
Hmm. What's amazing with like Midnight Meat Train is like, why would you put that much money into a film and then not ever want to like do anything with it? You know, I don't know how much Trick or Treat was, but I'm sure Midnight Meat Train at least cost several million dollars to make. And then it's like, if you're just going to dump it into, you know, $1.50 theaters, where the most you're going to make is $1.50 on a ticket, and you're not going to promote it or anything, it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I saw previews for that movie before Rambo, which came out in January of 08, I think, and they said it was coming in March, and then they keep fluctuating, and studios change heads, and it's just senseless to me. I don't know why the studios can't commit to something once they have a, I mean, the internet buzz on this Trick or Treat movie is phenomenal, and there's no reason why they couldn't put it out and make a tidy profit. I'm sure it wasn't, you know, that expensive a film, and Saw doesn't need to dominate every October. I mean, there's room for one more film, I think, and they just won't even try it.
Hmm. Well, you know, as far as like horror being too PC or anything like that, when I think about that, I think of like PG-13 films and stuff like that, which I know some people are like, well, you can't judge a film based on the rating, and there's been some good scary films that are PG-13, but that's a relatively new trend to steer a film towards that specific market now. I think they do that with all films now, even more so than they ever did. But it's like they'll take a film, the director will direct it the way that he wants to, and it's rated R at that point. And then they'll just go back and be like, all right, what the fuck, how can I dice this up so it gets PG-13? So you're not really even getting the real film, you're just getting the version that they had to re-edit to make it PG-13, and that's what drives me nuts. It's like, all right, if you just set out to make a PG-13 film, that's one thing. But if you make an R film, and then you go back because you don't have the balls, the studio's telling you, you know, that you have to do PG-13 stuff, and you re-edit it, that's lame.
And it's also senseless because, you know, Drag Me to Hell and now this Land of the Lost with its terrible opening, not just because you have a rating that will allow young kids to get into it, that none of that has anything to do with why a film is successful. They think that it opens up the demographic and they can get a larger, you know, cross-section of people into the theater, but if the film isn't any good or people aren't interested in it from the looks of it, if it doesn't appeal to them on a base level, they're not going to go anyway. I mean, Drag Me to Hell didn't set the box office on fire. That didn't help them whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would it have made more if it was R? I doubt it.
I just want to know, though, are kids really having, like 13, 14-year-olds really having that much trouble getting into, like when we were kids, You can be fucking 7 years old and get into an R-rated movie.
Yeah, but I think in bigger cities, it's different in bigger cities, isn't it, guys? Because around here, they don't give a fuck. As long as you have money, you know, they're not going to turn anybody away.
I don't know the neighbor by my house. They actually check IDs now for rated R stuff. But I think, like, the whole thing with the PG-13 films is, like, yeah, I think they make the films PG-13 to hopefully get, you know, more people into the theater to see it. But, like, with hardcore horror fans, a lot of times when they see a movie as PG-13, they'll just avoid it. And at the same time, if they make it R, a big problem that I have noticed is that, like, for instance, it was, let me see, Hills Have Eyes remake, when we went and saw that. You know, it's a rated R film. No one under 17 is allowed to come into the film. Me and my wife went there. There was maybe, like, three other people. And then I would say once the previews got going, all of a sudden, all these kids came into the theater. They obviously, like, snuck in. You know, they probably bought a ticket to something else, and they went and saw the film they wanted to. But studios can lose a lot of money that way, too. So it's just, I don't think it matters either way if they make it R or PG-13. Either they're going to lose money on the little kids sneaking in to see an R-rated film, or they're going to lose out on the hardcore horror fans who won't go see it because it's PG-13.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to look at, though. I would be interested in seeing what the last big hit horror film was that wasn't a remake.
God.
I'd probably have to say, probably Grindhouse.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
No, there's usually there's not any at all that I can really think of. I mean,
you probably have to go back.
Hell was okay, but it did, like 13 million, I think.
Yeah. You might have to go back to the first Saw movie, really.
Well, Saw movies make a ton of money because, like, I think the first Saw movie, they only spent $1 million to make it. You know, if that movie makes, you know, $24 million opening weekend, you know, that's a huge profit. I mean, that's why they'll keep making a Saw every single year because I think the last one, they maybe spent, like, $4 or $5 million on it, and it's guaranteed they always make 20.
They all look like they were filmed in the back of an abandoned Kmart, so, I mean, they're not spending money on location, and they're certainly not spending it on actors, so it's all profit, basically.
Yeah. So, who's next?
I'll go, I guess. Let's see. When you guys, I guess it was May 2006, you guys had Tom Savini on the show.
Sorry.
He made a pretty big announcement then about you guys asked him if he was doing any more films where he was doing makeup effects. And he announced on your show that he was no longer doing effects at all, which I had never heard of before that interview. I guess, what do you guys think is the reasoning behind Tom Savini quitting makeup effects? Would you like to see him return? And if he did return, do you think he could still have a major impact on the horror genre like he did in the 1980s?
Shit.
Well, I remember early on the show, me and Uncle Bill, we would have this argument whether or not, you know, Greg Nicotero, like, it's one of those deals where the student surpassed the teacher. And, I mean, Tom Savini, when it comes to, like, low-budget movies, direct-to-DVD movies, he could still be a makeup effects guy and probably do pretty good. But mainstream, there's no way. I mean, he just wasn't that good.
Yeah, I don't believe that anybody else was as creative as Savini in what he did. But as far as the quality of what he did, looking at it now as compared to Nicotero and stuff like that, that guy definitely, especially the sculpture wise and stuff like that, does 10 times better shit. But I mean, why do I think he quit? I think he felt like he was getting stereotyped. And I think Savini has a big enough ego that he thought he could branch off and be a serious actor. I mean, ever since Knight Riders and stuff like that, he's obviously had that desire to do that. It's just, it hasn't exactly turned out that great.
Well, going back to that story Romero told when you guys interviewed him about, you know, Savini walking in to the door and doing a backflip off the desk. And, you know, obviously he's very theatrical and, you know, his part in Dawn of the Dead, he's always wanted to do that. But, I mean, I don't think he has those leading man good looks, really. So it's not going to happen for him in the acting category unless he does small character roles. And I think as far as his makeup is concerned, he comes from a different age and where a lot of his effects are based on, you know, like you guys said, that David Copperfield, the Doug Henning. I mean, he would use the plastic and the latex and the fake blood, but then it would always be sort of like sleight of hand tricks where he would, you know, cut the scissors in half, or he would put someone underneath the bench. Like, it was like saw the lady in half type magic tricks, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And in this day and age, because of time and because of money, computer graphics have completely usurped the role that sort of old, you know, carnival style tomfoolery, you know. Now they just say, well, we don't have time for you to build it. Don't bother cutting that, you know, knife in half to make it, you know, like that's an arrow in the head, Steve Martin kind of a thing. Nowadays they'll just, we'll put some green tape around the end of it and we'll fix it in post, you know. We don't need this to go to that sort of trouble, which is sad because I think what he did was fantastic. And, mm-hmm. you know, it should be appreciated that he took a clever approach to solving those problems and to tricking people. I always liked that.
Yeah, well, you remind me, though, because I think George Romero needs Tom Savini in his movies right now because of the CG.
Definitely.
Yeah, he does.
Certain movies, you don't have a big budget, or at least a decent budget, never attempt CG. I mean, Land of the Dead was bad enough, but goddamn, Diary of the Dead, it looked like something, you know, the Anaconda from 1997, you know, bad.
I think Romero severely underestimated Savini's influence on why people like those movies so much.
I think the problem with Savini, though, is that he pretty much relied on Romero to put him to work. And when Romero's career pretty much dried up in the 90s, so did Savini's. I mean, if you look at Savini's credits, he did Trauma and Two Evil Eyes for Argento, but nothing really, like, noteworthy at all, I would say.
CK, I think you just made an excellent point, and that might be the one thing that could save where this downward trend in, you know, the dead films is going, because the only reason those movies had the impact they had is because you actually believed what was happening to those living dead was happening, and it was because it was real, because it was practical, you know, mm-hmm. because it did have, the squibs did have an impact. You didn't sit there thinking, oh, nice CGI muzzle flash, nice, you know, fake CGI blood. And to this day, I don't think I've ever seen a special effect better than in Day of the Dead when Major Cooper is, you know, laying on the table and his head's cut off and just the brain is exposed and the arms are going up. And I know that it's just the actor's head bent backwards on a table, but that looks absolutely fantastic. I don't think I've ever seen anything that looks better than that. And if Romero wants his movies to have any sort of impact like that again, he needs to go back to throwing those kind of images in there to really, really blast you, you know?
I don't think it's really Romero's fault, though, because I remember when Land of the Dead was coming out, when they were in pre-production, originally Savini was supposed to do the makeup effects for that film, and I think that was around the time when Savini just said, fuck it, I'm not doing makeup effects anymore, and that's when they put him in a different role as, you know, the Blade zombie. But I remember originally he was supposed to do the makeup effects for that film, and I'm sure Romero would use them, but I think it's just at this point it's just Savini being a stubborn fuck and thinking that he can, you know, do acting, and you know, it's not going to happen. He's going to end up being in, you know, The Lost Boys, To the Tribe, or was it Zack and Miri for like 10 seconds. You know, he's not going to ever really. I don't even know how he makes a living at this point, not doing makeup effects really.
Conventions maybe.
Yeah, conventions in that school, I would guess.
I thought he was fantastic in those hair plug commercials.
Yeah, I mean, I think, though, Romero could get, you know, he uses Greg Nicotero for makeups. Just get rid of the fucking CGI motherfuckers. That's horrible. I mean, I don't know how anybody could watch Diary of the Dead and think that looked good. And what was even more hilarious is those stupid makeup CGI effects guys talking about, like, each and every visual effect they did, like some masterpiece or something.
It's kind of like if Megadeth made a new album, but they had a banjo player in it. You'd be like, what the fuck? That doesn't belong in there.
It'd be like Junior Brown joining
yeah.
Junior Brown joining frickin' AC/DC or something.
Yeah. It's just those, you expected something out of those movies. The fans of the dead movies expected something, and you can't just, well, you can do that, but you see what happens. Okay, we will move on here a little bit.
I think Uncle Bill's the last topic.
This would be an interesting one. What is your fondest memory related to the horror genre?
Probably me be pissing my pants seeing Poltergeist 3. I think probably like my fondest memory, besides like meeting people at like conventions and stuff, which is always awesome. When I was like maybe 7 or 8 years old, I used to get, you know, ear infections a lot and stuff, and I'd be home from school a lot. And I remember my dad, he let me, go to the video store with him and rent any movie that I wanted to. I remember I rented, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which again, I don't know why the fuck he's let me watch these kind of movies when I'm like 7 years old. But yeah, he let me watch it, and he told me, don't tell your mom I let you watch this. And that movie just scared the fuck out of me. Like, I mean, that really bothered me a lot, and I don't know, just stupid stuff like that. I mean, nothing really, big. I would say that, another thing that sticks out of my mind when, what movie was it now? It was, Jason Goes to Hell. When that came out, I was like 13 years old, and I, remember I wanted to go see it real bad, but they actually wouldn't let me buy a ticket because it was rated R, so I ended up buying a ticket to, the re-release of Snow White that Disney put out, and I bought a ticket to that, and then I went and snuck into that movie instead, and remember sitting in the back of the theater, and that movie, I don't know, I haven't seen that movie really since then. I remember liking it a lot in theaters, but supposedly, I guess it's
love
with everybody. Talked about. I remember liking it, though, so.
I would say that, mine would, there's a couple of them, but I had a friend that used to live right next door to me, and he and I were both into the Fangoria and the Gore Zone, and we'd always go to the mom and pop and try to find everything we could and everything we read about, and he had a dad who was, you know, always turned a blind eye and never really had a problem, and he took us to see stuff like Phantasm 2 in the theater, and Nightbreed was a really, is that an old crappy rundown theater? We saw that, and that was a pretty awesome moment. And he also rented Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer for us when we were like 12, I think I was in sixth grade, and it was just great. He would get stuff like that, and Hellraiser 2 with us, so it was great to see all that stuff at such an early age and make me the fine, upstanding citizen I am today.
Yeah, I mean, mine is sort of similar to you guys, because when I was a kid, I mean, I got a VCR when I was like 7, 8 years old, something like that. And watching some of these movies for the first time, and a lot of the times, like a lot of the movies sucked, but you just remember as a kid that you thought all these movies were awesome just because of the cover, you know. I mean, you would see stuff, Slaughter High, which, you know, I love the cover. I don't think the movie's okay if you watch it now, but it's like, you know, just seeing stuff like that for the first time, watching Evil Dead 2. And for years, I thought Evil Dead 1 didn't even exist because I couldn't find a video of it. You know, so I'd only seen Evil Dead 2 up until I was like 15 years old. That was the only one I'd seen. And I just remember just going into these stores at a young age, and these old, you know, these mom and pop video rental stores were hilariously cheap back then too. Like, you would have this turd brown carpeting. We were talking about this the other day. The legendary now, I guess, New World Video, which they had like a whole room of nothing but horror movies. And I remember we used to go down there and rent as kids, and it, I don't know, just renting stuff, seeing it for the first time, I think. And more recently, I guess, going to see legendary movies like Suspiria in theaters and, you know, in 35mm was really cool too.
Yeah, I've got a couple too. I was thinking like going to see Land of the Dead when it came, even though I didn't like that movie at all, to be honest, but like going to see it with my dad, it was like a culmination. Like, he got me started with Dawn of the Dead, really. And then going to see that in theaters with him was like some sort of weird cyclical end to that or whatever. Even though we both did hate that movie. Also, the one that I could never tell, and I'm sure you share that too, but you probably forgot about it. And
oh, yeah. We can't talk about that. But it does involve a Scream Queen.
Yeah. And probably the biggest one, though, is what we were at Scarefest, and this woman came up, and she was like, I was really, really depressed. And, you know, I would come home every day, and I would watch you get raped by Michael Myers, and that would just, that would cheer me up. That would make everything okay. And I was like, that is the most bizarre fucking compliment ever, but I don't know. It was.
It warmed your heart.
It did. It warmed the cackles of my heart. So that's
I have a pretty crazy one I just thought of, actually. My brother, CK mentioned Evil Dead 2. My brother had it on like a like a bootleg tape, because back in the 80s, like VHS tapes were like $80, $90, you know, you couldn't really afford to buy them. But he had it on, you know, just a tape that he recorded. I remember I took it to my grandma's house. I was probably like maybe 9 years old or something, and I pressed play on it. I was watching the whole film, and she was like back there with me watching it. I don't know why. But as soon as the movie ended, a porno came on. There was a girl sucking this guy's dick, and I'm sitting there with my grandma watching.
Oh, God.
My brother wanted to kill me because, you know, it was like his secret stash. He didn't even know that I borrowed the tape from him, but that was like his porno tape that he had on. He was just had a mask, Evil Dead, so he got in big trouble.
Something that I was thinking of, though, like mentioning earlier, these movies, like even the really shitty movies, when you were a kid, like, I don't remember hating any horror movie.
I don't either.
Like, I would watch shit like Return to Horror High. I don't know if you guys remember that. I used to love that movie when I was a kid, and I can't watch it now, so.
Yeah, I've got a lot of movies like that. When you were talking about the mom and pop stuff, CK, I remember I hadn't thought of the movie Madman for probably, you know, 20-plus years, but when I was a kid, they had that poster where it was just, you know, in red letters or whatever, a madman on the bottom, and then the huge outline of Paul Ehlers,
right,
where he's holding the axe and you see that wispy hair. And I remember, you know, I was probably 7 or 8 years old seeing that and always thinking, that's got to be the most intense thing ever. I was just terrified of that image of him. And I catch the movie on IFC after you guys have talked it up so much, and I, well, it's pretty entertaining, I suppose, but it didn't live up to, as a second, third grader, what I thought it would do.
But Batman sucks.
Buddy, fuck you.
Fuck.
I didn't say it sucked. I'm just saying. But
I'm saying it sucks.
You suck.
Okay. But you talked before about how much you loved, on a previous roundtable, so I remember, about the poster art and the cover art and how they promised, you know, like the succubuses that tormented Uncle Frank in Hellraiser 2, they promise forever but never deliver, you know? Like all those covers where it was just that fantastical image that would make your mind go into overtime thinking what horrors could lay in store, and then you watch it, and it was more often than not, you know, some really bad actors wandering around for 40 minutes at a time doing absolutely nothing, but that cover will always stick with you, you know?
Yeah, there's so many covers like that, too, where it's just, it's the Herschel Gordon Lewis thing of, like, you design all the stuff, so, and Lloyd Kaufman does this, too, where the poster and stuff is more important than the actual film itself, and it's just so many films like that that we've seen.
The Supernaturals, do you guys remember that movie?
Jesus.
Is that where he's got the Rob Halford hat and the skeleton with the
he's got like, broken sunglasses.
That's like one of the coolest covers, but goddamn, that movie's horrible.
Unhinged. That Unhinged looked like, the cover of that movie looked like, God, I'm in for a fucking bloodbath. This is going to be absolutely amazing. Then you turn it on, it's like 2 hours of nothing. Just that, I don't think there's any blood in that movie.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of the slasher movies like that, like Terror on Tour is another one. I don't know if
have you guys ever seen the cover for Shockwave?
Yeah.
I remember thinking, boy, there's going to be 400-foot-tall Nazi zombies, and you rent it, and it's some guys with some pancake makeup wandering around in a lagoon for an hour and a half.
That's sort of like Zombie Lake as well. The Jolly Green Zombies.
Got a Werewolf on Wheels.
Oh, God. Yeah. There's literally, I don't think there's ever any werewolves on wheels besides for maybe 10 seconds in that movie.
Yeah.
That disappointed you, didn't it? There are werewolves on wheels. Yeah.
Well, just the concept.
Look at the cover. Look at the cover. It looks awesome. And then you watch it, and it's like, what the fuck is this shit?
Yep.
You can run from Suspiria.
Help me!
You can hide from Suspiria.
Who's there? Who's there?
But you cannot escape Suspiria. Once you've seen Suspiria, you will never again feel safe in the dark. Rated R. Under 17. Not admitted without parent.
All the times have come. Jason Mewes, and you're listening to DeadPit.com. Yes.
Welcome back. We're going to do some fucking fan questions now. What do you think about
that? Buddy, wasn't
that
a great round table?
That round table was off the chain, though, I got to admit. Had Adam Beck on there and Schlogs, and they were talking up a storm about a bunch of different shit.
DeadPit got schlogged.
He schlogged the fuck out of us, I don't know.
We got a good schlogging.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, we got a bunch of fan questions to get to. Well, we got about three. If you people want to send us more fan questions, you better get to it, because this segment is starting to piss me off.
I don't even care. You send whatever you want, I don't care.
Yeah. So, anyway, Russ Bucket, who does the budget DVD blog site, which is a good site. You know, if you want to get DVDs for cheap, definitely check it out. It says, hey guys, I was looking over my movie books and was wondering, do you guys have a favorite movie reference book? Something that you go, to when you have a question about a certain movie? I think for me, the two Psychotronic video books for general B movies, Chase Ballon's Ballon, I don't know how you pronounce that guy's last name. The Gore Score for Hardcore Horror Stuff, even though it's around 20 years old, and for a specific subject, The Book of the Dead, covering all things zombies. I wish there was something more recent that was all-encompassing, that was the level of the books above. Maybe you just think you can go on the internet, and maybe you guys know something I haven't heard of. Keep on keeping on, boys. Looking forward to buying you a round sometime.
Hmm.
You want to buy me a round of root beer? I don't drink liquor.
Movie reference, but I don't have any. I've got like Leonard Maltin's Guide to Movies, but most of the time
The Book of the Dead. You've got Friday the 13th, Crystal Lake Memories.
Yeah, like I don't know if that's what he's talking about or not, though. He seems to be talking about more like
he mentioned general Book of the Dead, though.
General like movie reference books, but yeah, as far as like on a particular series or a book that just has the best references for movies, it has to be Crystal Lake Memories book. That's by far the best one.
Let me tell you something, Russ Bucket. We don't need no books. We're horologists. If we have, you know, a question about a certain movie, all we got to do is dig deep into our minds, and we will find the answer.
Hmm. Yeah, so you're saying like we're like our own encyclopedias, is that what you're saying? Man, honestly, like, I always go to IMDb. Like, what the hell could I not find on IMDb?
Yeah, but the thing is, with IMDb and a lot of stuff is wrong.
Buddy, IMDb's never wrong.
Oh, really? It's fucking IMDb, fool.
Hmm. So let's go on here. We got to take a question from old Mick Wagner. Mick Wagner says, hey guys, I caught Drag Me to Hell this weekend, and it made me think of a question for y'all. I was enjoying the film pretty well, not the best ever, but pretty fun, up until the point where the main character sacrifices her kitten. At that point, I lost all sympathy for her character, because I have a rule. Whatever happens in a horror flick, no one kills the cat. I know it's pretty dumb to have a rule like that, but I can't help it. I grew up with a couple of pet cats, and whenever I see a scene in a flick like that, it just pisses me off, and I can't get settled in enough to enjoy the film anymore. So my question for y'all is, do you have any similar no-go areas in the genre? Events or subjects that completely unreasonably will make you completely dislike a film? Things that no one else would really care about?
Well, I guess I would sort of agree with you a little bit with... See, and it's not so much that it was a cat, but that it was a baby cat, like it was a kitten, you know? And I'm not so much against killing, like, grown animals, but if babies or baby animals or something, you know, I don't know. I mean, I agree with you about that scene, though. It didn't really, but the thing about Sam Raimi is in his movies, he doesn't really go by the rules in his movies a lot. So, I mean, that sort of explains it. But normally, I mean, that would be, you don't do that at all, especially for a sympathetic character, which this girl was supposed to be.
The thing I always hate about when films do is when they have real baby deaths. Like, that always gets to me for some
reason. Real baby deaths?
Yeah, when they
have that on an episode of Trace's Death.
Yeah, It always takes me out of
you
a film.
You say this little baby gets skull fucked after it's killed.
It always takes me out of a film, though, when the director decides to bring in a real baby and kill it.
Does it?
Yeah. I don't like that.
Yeah, I think our good buddy Yorg B. Garrett did that. He not only killed the baby, but after the baby was dead, he shit on its head.
He did. He raped it and shit on its chest.
So he fed it to one of his pit bulls.
I'm not shitting you. There was one movie where I was like, speaking of Yorg B. Garrett, where I think we were watching Necromantic 2, and there's a scene in it where it just for no reason whatsoever shows a bunch of scenes of dolphins and shit being
baby
slaughtered.
Seals getting
yeah.
clubbed.
And I was like, that took me out of that movie a little bit because it was just so gratuitous and unnecessary.
What's
and
hilarious is there's an audience for that stuff and people actually think he's like a genius.
Yeah, he is a genius for sure.
Yolk butt butter. I don't like it. Yeah, but I mean, what do you think about the scene though, seriously, and Drag Me to Hell with the girl sacrificing the little kitten?
Well, like you said, it's Sam Raimi. You kind of expect something like that to be in those films, something that just takes you completely off guard.
Expect the unexpected.
Yeah. The only thing that's for sure is that nothing's for sure.
Last question we got here is from Rambo Fan. He says, first off, I just saw that Legend of Bigfoot film because they had the whole movie for free on YouTube. Holy fucking shit. My question, do you remember the Abel Ferreira 90s version of Body Snatchers? And if so, what do you think of it?
It's going to be a quick one for me because I have no idea.
That's a classic film, Uncle Bill, from Abel Ferreira.
The 90s version of the only one I remember is the one with, what's his name, Donald Sutherland?
Yeah.
That's the Invasion of the Body Snatchers one. I guess that was like 78 or something.
Well, you've seen the original one, haven't you? The
one with, what's that guy's
one
name?
From the 50s or whatever it was?
Yeah, I have seen it on television. What the hell's that guy's name that was in? He's also in UHF. He's been in like a million films.
Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah, Weird Al. That's
him.
That's him.
See you in that.
I don't know why think about that guy. I think UHF. I'm sure he's been in like a million other films.
But, I mean, I guess one series of movies that I never really was a fan of was the whole body snatcher craze, body invasion movies. I just never got into them. I mean,
You like The Hidden?
Well, yeah, but I think that was more of an action movie than anything else. I mean, it didn't really have a whole lot of horror elements to it. I don't know, I never did get into that. I think that The Faculty did it really well. I mean, that was one that was, I think that was in the 90s. They did that. I think that was another early Robert Rodriguez movie. And there's been a couple of other ones. There was another one recently. Shit. Which one was it? Not too long ago.
It was a body snatcher movie.
Yeah, it was like a body switch movie or, you know, that same thing. I can't remember. There's been a ton of them.
I don't know. They probably called it Switchers or something like that, Nelly.
Well, that sounds like something. The Invasion of the Body Switchers from the Asylum.
Yeah.
Sounds about right. So, but that's it for the fan questions. Well, golly, buddy, what do you think of that? I only got three of them.
We rocked that out. There's so many of them. I don't think I can keep up with this fan mail.
Bastards.
Assholes.
Yeah. But, I mean, if the fan questions don't... Because there's a ton of motherfuckers posting that message board. But have we answered all the questions, Uncle Bill? Are there no more questions for the horologists?
I guess not. I guess we've come to that point in our careers where we have suitably answered every single question related to horror film or horror or anything else. Hmm. So we can just quit now. I mean, it's over with.
That's true. We may just have to quit, folks, if you don't fucking send us more questions. Because I've had it.
How'd you like that? How'd you like that if we quit?
Anyway. That's it for the fan questions. Like we were saying, we're going to take a break. We've got DVDs to get to. I'm actually looking forward to talking about both of these movies, Uncle Bill, so it should be fun. We've had about 2 weeks worth of shit, crap, and fuck. So it's about time we had some decent movies to review on here.
Hey, look, I'm not going to sit here and listen to you degrade the booby hatch anymore.
Look here, son. I'll degrade whatever I want to.
No!
The only reason you like the booby hatch so you can see those men, hairy balls in that.
Oh, God! Look at that. I bet you's waiting on some kind of shit on somebody's chest.
Hey, oh. But I got a joke for you.
Oh, God.
Don't tell too many jokes on here. I heard this one the other day and thought it was interesting. What is the last noise a pubic hair makes before it hits the ground?
I have no idea. Oh! Oh, God.
Anyway, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back to raise some more Hell Lord here on
DeadBit.com.
Jack Shoulder, director of Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and The Hidden and many other wonderful movies. You're listening to Dead Pit Radio.
Jennifer is the new girl in a strange school. She's taunted by her classmates, haunted by a deadly secret.
Not normal.
And caught up in a murderous wave of terror.
When the murderer hides his victims, he'll make physical contact with them.
But Jennifer's got a few million close friends.
Insects never hurt me. I love all insects.
You're in a position to do extraordinary things.
And she's going to need every one of them. Creepers.
That fly is your magic wand. Ask him to lead you where the dead bodies are hidden, and he'll lead you.
From one of the most acclaimed masters of suspense comes the chilling tale of a young girl trapped in a web of evil. Dario Argento's Creepers. It will make your skin crawl.
In artificial season, covered by some rain. Losing all my reason, this is nothing left to blame.
Hi, this is Lucky McKee, director of May, and you're listening to Dead Pit Radio.
Shadows paint.
Welcome back, folks. Thank you for sticking in with us this week on Dead Pit. I hope you all enjoyed the round table. It was a lot of fun. What an Uncle Bill.
It was awesome. And talking with Schlogs and Adam Beck again.
Yeah, I think the Dead Pit community just got Schlogged.
I sure did.
So, we got a couple of announcements to make. First off, there's a new lovely lady of Dead Pit. Woo, baby, and she's lovely to say the least.
She's fucking luscious.
That's right. We have our good buddy Rachel Sullivan, who's no relation to Kevin Sullivan.
Wow. Oh.
She's got some lovely pictures on there. Highly suggest you guys check them out. I'm surprised at how many lovely ladies have emailed us so far, Uncle Bill, and sent us gorgeous photos.
It's a lady. It sure is.
I want some Cavathier now, Uncle Bill. So, we got that. You got to check out, of course, the Blue Inferno for all you Blu-ray lovers out there. It's a brand new collaboration channel, Uncle Bill, that you're not a part of, buddy, because you don't like Blu-rays.
I don't have the power of Blu-ray, so I'm not in the clique.
Shit on you.
Oh.
But we are going to debut, I think, the first video from the Blue Phantom, the world's first Blu-ray reviewing luchador.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. He was, yeah, he was a world-famous luchador at one time.
And now he's a Blu-ray reviewer.
Was he the Executioner 2 or 3?
I think he was one of the creatures.
Okay. That makes sense.
So, yeah, check all that stuff out. J-Real will probably have a new interview up. I'm thinking we're going to have part one of our multi-part poster collection series. Hopefully by sometime this weekend. I think a lot of people are looking forward to it. We have a lot of fucking posters to talk about. I was thinking a lot of the stuff we have, we do have similar posters. I mean, there's not a lot of stuff that we don't have that, you know, isn't common between the both of us, I guess.
We've got some similar stuff, but we've also got a lot of different stuff. As I look around here, I'm noticing some stuff. Like, I don't have a Monster Squad poster. I don't have a Don't Go in the Woods poster. I've got most of the rest of this shit, though, I have to admit.
Do you have the Texas Chainsaw Massacre video poster?
Yeah.
I've got mine signed, though. You don't have yours signed.
No.
Anyway, check that out. I think a lot of people are going to dig it. It's mainly going to be our frame stuff that we have up so far. And then over the next week, few weeks, we're going to be showing you all of them because we have quite a few.
Yeah, the frame stuff is not going to really put a dent in the amount of shit that we both have, I'm sure.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to dive right into the reviews this week. These are both fan-requested reviews. I guess we can start off with one that a fan actually sent us to review. It's Jack Ketchum's The Girl Next Door and was inspired by actual events and is directed, of course, by Gregory M. Wilson of the famous Washington Wilsons.
Right, yeah. This movie, I had seen almost an exact copy of this movie called An American Crime, and it's based on the same story that Ketchum wrote about. It was just weird because you couldn't help but compare the two films because they're almost exactly the same. It's a story of this kid who's having these flashbacks. Or, I'm sorry, this guy who's having these flashbacks about when he was a kid, and he ran into this girl who was, you know, really nice to him. Treated him
lovely.
Yeah, he kind of had a crush on her, too, I think. And she was she adopted or was she a foster?
I think that this family sort of adopted her and her crippled sister.
Right.
Because their parents had died, and they were... I think that the mother was their aunt or something like that. I'm not for sure. But this, it leads us to this sadistic sort of family where I think the mother's name is Aunt Ruth or Annie Ruth or something like that. She lets all of her kids drink beer and she's sort of like one of the fellas. I mean, she tries she doesn't want the kids to see her as a mother figure, more as just a friend and somebody to bullshit with, but she's also at times, especially towards these adoptive kids, really, really strict and does a lot of brutal things to them.
Well, it starts off with her kind of just being dismissive of them and rude to them and stuff, and then, like, as time goes on, and the young girl starts to try to break away and get away from the family, she realizes that, you know, she has to do something to keep her in line, otherwise she's going to tell on her for being such a bitch to her, essentially. And so what happens is she ends up chaining her up in the basement of this house. And systematically, it's just torturing her, and things start to get worse and worse. There's all these neighborhoods.
They take a blowtorch to a pussy, baby. That was nasty.
They sure do. There's all these boys that live around the neighborhood that she kind of... It's like a dim mother too, and she gives them beer and cigarettes and all this shit, and they're there too, and it's like they're all curious about
all this stuff, but so they start to have sex with her and they start to torture her. And it kind of shows like what happens if there's no, parental restraint on kids and they're left to their own devices and, you know, and they're given a, basically a human being to just treat like a doll or something.
Yeah. And this movie, it was based on actual events, evidently, but Jack Ketchum, it's one of his most famous stories, I guess. It was one of those things, though, where this movie had sort of a reputation of being overly, I think a lot of people were saying it was gory and brutal and stuff like that. And I kept waiting for the, I mean, maybe I'm just a sadistic son of a bitch, but I just kept waiting for those scenes, and I mean, I didn't see anything that was...
Well, the clip blow-torching scene was a bit much, but...
Yeah, but I mean, it was all suggestive. Yeah. I mean, you didn't really... They didn't show it or anything.
I think people see what they want to see in that stuff anyway. I mean, just the suggestion that that's what's going to be happening.
Yeah.
Enough to make people shit their pants.
I got to say, though, I mean, I liked this movie. I thought it was a fun movie, and it was... I love how it was shot. You know, I think that it really captured the late 1950s, the look of it, you know? But I gotta say, it's not as good as An American Crime, which we reviewed, which I'm surprised by, because American Crime was released by a smaller studio and just didn't have the reputation of this movie. But I thought that overall was probably a better movie.
Yeah, I did too, honestly, because as much as I like this movie as well, it just, after you see An American Crime, I think it's a better made, put together movie than this movie is. And although I liked Aunt Ruth, Blanche Baker, I thought the woman, Blanche Baker, did a better job as that character than even, what was her name, Kathleen Kinlan?
I gotta disagree with you on that, though, because, okay, well, in some respects, because the Catherine Keener character, her character in that, it was more like you could see that she was fucked in the head. She was just psychologically, she didn't realize what she was doing. So it was more depth there, I guess, where just the Annie Ruth character was just an evil bitch. She didn't have, you know, she was just a mean son of a bitch, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I just like that characterization better for some reason. And she looks... Like, they couldn't find anybody that looked a better part than
looked
this
like
woman.
More of a hag.
Like an old hag. Yeah. I don't know. But, yeah, for all the recommendations that people have been giving about this movie, I mean, it was good and everything, but I wasn't completely blown away by it like a lot of people said they were. It wasn't something that shocked and astounded me either, like a lot of people said.
I mean, it was an interesting watch. Definitely worth like $6 or whatever it is now. You know, you can buy it new. And I'll definitely recommend it for that, but... As far as the big reputation it gets on message boards, horror fans and stuff, it's just not that good, in my opinion. But that's The Girl Next Door.
Yeah, you can go pick it up from StarsHomeEntertainment.com.
No. The next one, though, we have up is a Blu-ray. Woo! We're going to review a Blu-ray on here, Uncle Bill. And you've actually seen it.
I have. It's not in the case, though. What'd you do with it?
It's still in the Blu-ray player.
We're going to be talking about Punisher Warzone.
Yeah, this is Punisher Warzone, the two-disc special edition, which is really only one-disc edition with a goddamn digital copy. I hate when they do that.
It's two discs, though. They put two actual discs.
I don't expect this one disc. It's just the same fucking thing as... It's just a movie.
Buddy, look. You can watch that on your iPod.
Does anybody watch movies on their fucking iPod?
Though? I do. I watch them on my iPod.
It's like watching a movie on a Game Boy.
Okay, so we'd heard a lot about this. This was like a topic on the message board to try to get us to review this movie because a lot of people really, really liked it, and a couple of people didn't like it at all. I know Rambo was one of the people that didn't like it at all. So we had to watch it eventually. And you've had this for quite a while.
I've had it for about 2 months.
So... We watched it. And there's good news and there's bad news.
Okay, first, let's just talk about the bad news first. And then we'll, you know, everybody can mark out their good news.
Yeah.
The bad news is the guy that plays the Punisher is horrible.
Ray Stevenson. Oh, yes,
Where the fuck did they find the guy? Where did they find him?
We were talking about this. I don't know. I don't know where he came from.
He just can't act. He has no emotion at all. He really has hardly any lines in the movie. You know, I know that Thomas Jane was originally going to come back in this, and there was some sort of scheduling conflicts and stuff. But shit, you could have got somebody better than him.
I mean, this guy makes fucking Dolph Lundgren look like Sally Field as far as emotion goes.
Yeah. What makes this movie, I mean, and the movie itself is pretty much just an 80s action movie mixed with, like, you know, modern superhero stuff. I don't think that the Punisher, I wouldn't say, like, Punisher's not really a superhero or anything, but just the villains have that over-the-top, like, comic look to them, you know? I think the guy's name's Jigsaw.
Yeah. I actually like that aspect of it, though. Yeah. Like, I like my superhero movies to actually kind of appear cartoonish that.
Jigsaw in this looked a little bit like something they would have in Dick Tracy back in
the... Yeah, it did, really.
Yeah.
Forget the guy. Who was the guy that played Jigsaw? Do you remember?
Dominic West.
Yeah, he was really over the top in like a Jack Nicholson kind of Joker way.
Something else that was great in this is just the horrible ass, like, New England accents that everybody had. Oh, let's get to the car!
You fucking mook! Like they always...
What's wrong with you over here?
And fucking, the one guy from Green Mile was in it too. I never can remember that guy's name. He was in The Burrowers recently as well.
Yeah, what was the fucking character's name in it too? It was hilarious.
Something shit. It's like he was insane. It was something.
Looney Bin Jim or something like that. What the fuck? Was that a character in the...
That was Looney Bin Jim.
Or something like that, I don't know. Was that a character in the comic book? I don't even know. I was never...
I don't remember that character in the comic book.
But, you know, this movie is a great action movie that has over-the-top special effects, over-the-top gore. I mean, there is more gore in this than probably any other superhero movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, my God, like... I mean, even though the Punisher in of itself, like the character of the Punisher, is not supposed to have a lot of emotion and stuff like that because he's like a killer and all this stuff. Still, with Ray Stevenson, like, there's nothing there. There's no reason whatsoever for you to like him in this at all. But the action scenes in this movie far make up for that fact. Like the fact that he's a shitty Punisher, it doesn't really even matter because the action and the gore and stuff in this is well worth the DVD. Like there's scenes in this where I couldn't even believe what they did in being like a mainstream movie.
It's a fun movie. I'm surprised Rambo didn't like this, actually, now that I'm watching, because it seems like the type of stuff that he normally loves. But hell, we all have, I don't know. The Punisher was bad. I mean, the Ray Stevenson, I think that they could have found almost anybody would have done a better job than him. I mean, you probably could have got Edward Furlong in there to be the Punisher, and he might have been just as good.
Yeah, you could replace that guy with anybody now, though, if they ever make another one.
But the Blu-ray itself, I thought the Blu-ray looked fucking amazing on Blu-ray.
The Blu-ray looked amazing on Blu-ray. It sure did.
The movie itself looked amazing on the Blu-ray disc.
But if you don't know the story of the Punisher, I'll give you a quick recap of what this movie is about, really. A bunch of mobsters killed his family. He's taking revenge on them by killing all of them. He's also being hunted by the FBI. And, like, one particular, like, one of the worst characters in any fucking, any movie, really, is his, was it his partner at one time, or his friend or something? This guy that was looking for him and all this stuff.
They kill him.
He's just this goofy, you remember
the guy from Seinfeld, wasn't it? Or what was that show he was on?
I don't remember. I don't think he was on a show. You remember the guy I'm talking about, though, don't you? The guy that had all the, that got up with the black guy to help him find him. I was like, what the hell? That's one of the stupidest characters ever.
But this movie, I mean, I think that this movie had a lot what the first movie didn't, but it also had something that that was really important in the first movie. It didn't really tell you the backstory too much. Like, the thing I liked about the Thomas Jane Punisher is, I mean, I agree, like, John Travolta was horrible as a heel in that. I mean, that was the biggest problem with that movie, in my opinion. But, like, they set it up, like, the revenge factor, they set it up perfectly. Like, he was one of the most evil motherfuckers on the planet to kill not only the Punisher's wife and kid, but his entire fucking family at this family reunion. And you were missing that in this movie. You didn't really know much about the Punisher because this essentially is a remake. I mean, they didn't really follow much of anything from the original Punisher movie, which a lot of people hate the original Punisher. I don't think it's the best movie ever, but I think that it's definitely better than the Dolph Lundgren Punisher movie.
Fuck you.
And this is like a million times better than the Dolph
Lundgren. There's nothing Punisher. Better than Dolph Lundgren's Punisher.
But that's the Punisher Warzone. If you want to have a great demo disc for Action Pack Night on Blu-ray, this is a great one to get.
Yeah, it's a fun action movie. Just don't take it seriously, otherwise you'll be in trouble, because it's very much like a comic book movie.
It is, for sure. I think it's the very first release from Marvel Knights as well, which is the new division in Marvel that releases like more of a dark-style comic book.
Well, they'll fold soon, then. Because any company that starts a division like that, it eventually fucking folds.
But you know what I'm saying, though? It's comic book characters in more of an extreme movie.
It's fucking brutal.
I should have called it Marvel Brutal. So anyway, that is it for Punisher Warzone. And I guess that's it for the show, Uncle Bill. What are we doing next week?
Oh! I don't know. What are we doing?
Fucking with that Mike Tombs.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't know what we're doing.
Nobody knows what we're
doing. We might just have a fan pit.
We don't even know what we're doing next week.
Because we're currently trying to book guests of the show. If you have any suggestions, email us. We're not going to interview any more independent people for a long damn time. So if you listen to this, don't even push that shit on us. Don't do it. We've interviewed enough independent people lately.
That's right.
So all you independent motherfuckers, you're going to have to
wait. You're going to be even more independent because you're going to get any help from us.
We might be calling you in December or something. Probably not, though. Anyway, we will be back next week to talk horror. As only we can, because we're the innovators of Horror Talk Radio.
Here on DeadPirate.com.
Lost my love, lost my